Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 165, entitled, How to Develop Your Flow State of Mind to Overcome Obstacles and Achieve Success Like a Navy SEAL, I chat with Eric Davis. Eric Davis is a former Navy SEAL and Navy SEAL sniper instructor, current high-performance trainer and coach, and the author of the book Raising Men. In today's episode, Eric talks about his incredibly challenging but rewarding career as a Navy SEAL. He covers the tough training conditions, the obstacles and missions he had to face, the stress he had to endure, and how he was not only able to survive, but actually thrive in this environment. Eric breaks down the mindset, determination, and flow state he taught himself to enter to perform at his best and propel him to massive success both in and outside of the military. If you're wondering what it's like being a part of the most elite group of badass men on the planet and how you can develop some of the most important mental characteristics of these men, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. And now, a quick word from our fantastic sponsors. And by the way, all of our sponsors can be found in the show notes or at elitemanmagazine.com in the show's description, where you can click their links and check out the special offers they have for our Elite Man audience. The Elite Man Podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/elite to support the show and see if you qualify. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-minded individuals. You, being an Elite Man Podcast listener, are almost certainly among those health-conscious people. That's why you should really listen up. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. So Health IQ rewards you for being active and taking care of yourself. How cool is that? Look, you never know what's going to happen, especially if you're married, have children, or you've had personal scares or family members dealing with health issues. This is something you definitely cannot take lightly. It's so important to make sure your loved ones are kept safe no matter what, and Health IQ helps you do that. It's the fastest growing life insurance company in the world with over $5 billion in coverage, and they're rated 9.6 out of 10 by Trustpilot. Do yourself and your family a huge favor and check out Health IQ. To see if you qualify for an incredible savings of up to 33%, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/elite, or mention the promo code ELITE when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Again, that's healthiq.com/elite.
You want to look good in your underwear and be comfortable, right? But that perfect balance is hard to find. Don't sacrifice style or comfort. Check out MeUndies.com and find the best pair of underwear in the world. MeUndies will be the most comfortable pair of underwear you will own. It's made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that's 3 times softer than cotton. I have on a pair of MeUndies right now, and I have to be honest, it feels absolutely incredible. They're the ultimate feel-good undies for when you want to feel naked, but not actually be naked. For you gentlemen, MeUndies' diamond seam pouch cradles your jewels and gives your stuff the support it needs without feeling too tight. And the ladies will love the soft, eco-friendly fabric as well. Right now, MeUndies has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get 20% off your first pair, plus free shipping. MeUndies is so sure you will love their underwear, they even offer a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't love your first pair, you get a full refund. This is a no-brainer to try. 20% off, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go to MeUndies.com/elite. That's MeUndies.com/elite. This is a limited time offer, so what are you waiting for? Start wearing the best underwear of your life. It changed my life. It's time to let MeUndies change yours as well. Go to MeUndies.com/elite right now.
All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Eric Davis from EricDavis215.com. Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. As I mentioned in the intro a moment ago, you are a former Navy SEAL and also a Navy SEAL sniper instructor, which is really cool. I want to dive into, I want to cover a number of things in today's episode because I think Navy SEALs are some of the most fascinating people in the world in my experience, and they just have such a breadth of knowledge to share with so many guys especially. But before we dive into that, can you just tell the listeners for a minute or two what your backstory is? I know we have the Navy SEAL covered. How did you get into that? What made you decide to become this Navy SEAL, which is one of the most elite groups in the world? How did you go from being just kind of an average citizen to being a part of one of the most exclusive groups in the world?
Sure. Well, it was more of a, I would say it's a progression, I think, like things like that are for many people. When I was young, about 14, 15 years old, my father was everything to me. Black hair, 6'2", olive skin. He was the captain of the sheriff's department, bishop of our church. Yeah, I'm only 5'9", red hair, freckles, or at least I was back then. So I got all the good genes, I tell people, but he was my everything. And he got sick, and I was just old enough to realize that I needed him, but too young to be without him. So that led me on this pursuit. Like, I knew I needed to find somebody or something to fill in that gap that I was already starting to experience as he was getting sick, and kind of not that he pulled out of my life immediately, but just slowly kind of came out of my life that way. So I did, you know, what everyone else would do, or, you know, read books, you know, at the time as books or motivational things on tapes. A lot of my brother was an entrepreneur, so he had sent me a lot of that stuff when I was very young, and found that none of that really did anything. So I did, you know, took the next natural step and joined the Navy to become a SEAL. And I thought, whoa, what a great place to learn how to become a man, fill in some of these gaps. I was really kind of waiting to get till the age of 21 so I'd be old enough to join the sheriff's department. And I thought, wow, what's the best training? What is the best background I could possibly get to get myself ready for this career? And I never ended up going that direction because I kept going so long in the SEAL teams. But that was the genesis of what led me into it.
Was there anything in your background prior to that when you were 15 or 16 years old that maybe gave you an idea that you would want some kind of life in the military? Was there something that stood out from, say, your childhood, or maybe a few things that stood out that kind of geared you into wanting to lead that life?
Absolutely. When I was young, if I grew up in today's world, I would have been diagnosed and just riddled with medication, I'm sure. But I was very active, hyperactive, some might say. I would not call it a disorder. Anytime lots of energy and the desire to go outside and do a lot of amazing things is called a disorder. You got to really wonder about where that's coming from.
Yeah.
But nowadays they do that. So I grew up in like townhouses that were inverted, like the front doors were pointed in. So it was almost like growing up in this little kind of, I don't know, tribe area. It was all inside. So I had the run of the place. And I remember having kind of problems, just, you know, the things that happen when you're not out and about having fun or living adventure or getting all the batteries burned down in your body, until I was old enough to go out and play by myself. And then all I did was climb trees. You know, we'd wear camouflage, we'd play, you know, war, we'd do all the things that young boys do. And that would be the earliest indicator of me having that kind of military desire. And really what drove it was the adventure and the outdoors and the physical aspect to it.
How about like sports? Was sports a big part of your life, or were you more of like an outdoors kind of kid and just doing things all the time outdoors?
Sports were definitely a big part of my life. I played soccer and baseball, you know, every year. I was old enough from kid to right up about high school. I played varsity soccer in high school, and that's when I started to taper off of that kind of thing. And sports were good because it required me to, you know, physically exert myself, which was, that's all part of the package when you have lots of energy. But, you know, as I think back on my childhood, it's not the sports that I remember. It's the time in the back area of my townhouse, in the bushes, in the trees. It was the adventure. It was the hide and go seek. You know, it was all those kind of games that you played that really impacted me. So sports were a piece of it. And I do believe sports even now are an important part of, you know, taking care of ourselves as men. But there's just nothing like the true adventure and being out in the dirt and the mud.
Yeah, I'm sure that definitely carried with you later in your Navy SEAL days when you were out doing missions and things like that, where everything's outside and it's constantly being in the woods or doing different things where you have to learn how to survive and adapt to the natural environment as opposed to being, you know, inside like so many kids these days are playing video games and things like that. That definitely gave you a step up on a lot of other kids going into your military career, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It made a huge impact. And it did carry forward quite a bit. And again, that's why activities like that are so very important as well.
So moving forward into your military experience, what was the first day of boot camp like for you going into the Navy and being just a regular kid off the street and hopping into your first day at military school at boot camp? Is that like one of the craziest experiences? Is it shattering to your ego and things of that nature? Or is it kind of like more for you came natural and wasn't really a big thing?
For me, it was definitely, I would say most of it all came natural. Military training, boot camp, across the board, it was definitely a sweet spot for me. It was the time in my life where I was in an environment doing things that I was good at, that I was better than most of the people around me. So it wasn't any kind of gnarly impact to me at all. It was really a positive experience. And I really spent most of my time just kind of saying, wait, isn't there more to this, or isn't this going to get harder? And not that it didn't have its challenges, but I definitely was comfortable in it and ready for it as well. And I prepared myself quite a bit because it was on my mind. By the time I was 15, this idea of becoming a SEAL really started to sink in. So by the time I got to boot camp, it had been 2+ years of just thinking about this very thing. So I was just ready to experience all that it had for me.
So how many years were you in just the regular Navy for? Was it like 4 years? I have some numbers here. 16 years in the military, 10 years on the SEAL team, and 5 years as a sniper instructor. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So it was a total of 16 years in the Navy. It was, I think, about 3 in the regular Navy as a medic. And I drove ambulances out of El Toro in Orange County, California. Worked out of Naval Hospital, Long Beach. And then I went to the Marine Reconnaissance Unit out of Camp Pendleton, and I spent a couple 3 years there. And what's that? There's about 6. Yeah, so about 3 years. And then I went to SEAL. I actually went to SEAL training, quit, got out of the Navy, and so left altogether, came back, went back to SEAL training, graduated, then stuck around as a SEAL for 10 years. And half of that time I spent as a sniper instructor. Now, it's normal to spend a couple 3 years as an instructor in that time period, but it was something I got really, really good at. Myself and Brandon Webb really dug in to the training aspect. So we ended up staying as an instructor for 5 years, which was a little bit uncommon.
And so talk about the Navy SEAL training for a minute. How tough is that compared to regular Navy training and some of the other military branch training? How much of a shell shock is that when you go into that? Because everybody says, like, hands down, Navy SEALs are the toughest guys in the world mentally and physically, and the training is just brutal. I forget the exact percentage. You probably know it, of how many people actually drop out of the training and don't pass. What is that like, and how tough was it?
Yeah, it's hard to describe. One of the things that makes it so tough is it's so long. So SEAL training, BUDS, basic underwater demolition SEAL training, that's what it stands for, BUDS. That's like, you're going to be there 7-8 months. You know, you get there, you have some time before you class up, you do pre-training, then you do training, all said and done, you're there for a chunk of time. And I would say the most accurate description is any one evolution, like you go to the O course and do that, you go on a conditioning run, you do PT in the morning, you do the IBSs, those rubber rafts, or you're doing surf passage, diving, climbing, whatever you want to call it. Any one thing isn't really that bad. A decent athlete, so anyone who can pass the physical screening test, that you're like, okay, physically speaking, you're going to be able to do these things. It's doing them back to back, going to eat, and then coming back and doing it back to back, going to eat, coming back, getting your gear ready, sleeping, and then starting the day over again, over and over and over again, day after day, week after week, month after month. That's the challenge for most people. Now, there's been some books now that have come out, and they're talking about how Navy SEALs and and different people are affecting the way we live and work. And one of the things they point to, I don't think they quite understand the how it works, but one of the things they point to is a psychological phenomenon called the state of flow. Some people call it being in the zone, but I would say that's what really separates people in SEAL training. And why I'm bringing that up is because if you were to say, Eric, what was your experience inside of SEAL training? Was it horrible? Was it so hard? Was it super difficult? I would say no. For me, because I'll easily slip into this thing, this state of flow, where kind of I shut down and I go inside of myself and all, you know, time and space kind of hold still. You know, you do like a 5.5 nautical swim and you're in the water for 6 hours or something like that. For some guys, it's grueling. It's torture. They're cold. They're uncomfortable. You know what I mean? So for some guys, it's horrible. But for me, it's like, it's gone. It's just a blink. It's just, I'm in my head the whole time. And I bring that up because it's important, because everyone thinks about grit and perseverance. And sure, there are definitely hard, difficult things that you have to muscle your way through. But the missing piece is to understand that state of flow, how to put yourself in it and stay in it. That's when you do these amazing things. Does that make sense how I'm saying that? So yes, there's toughness and everything like that, but that's not the that's not the piece. It's that flow state that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. I think that is really the key. I mean, you know, recurring theme over and over again is people that can enter that state of mind, and that's when great things tend to really happen, is when, you know, they're focused on just one thing, and that's completing the task at hand, and all other distractions get out of their head. What are some of the ways that you've figured out to enter into that zone, that state of flow? Is that something, again, that came naturally to you, or is it something maybe that they teach and then you kind of took to another level, or just developed on your own with your own sort of intuitive nature?
I would say it came natural to me, but you got to be careful with that, because people think it was just there. Here's why but it did show up for me as a gift. Like I said, I had a ton of energy, very, very active as a kid. And when you're very active and your mother understands that you need to be out and about doing your thing, otherwise you'll kind of burn up inside, you have an opportunity to explore physical and mental spaces. So I was left to my own devices that way. So it was like a breeding ground for flow state. And think about it, if you have a ton of energy, you're going to be moving hours after hours, and you're just going to go into yourself. So I had that opportunity growing up. It never was capped. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, and I'm not trying to stand up on my soapbox and compare, you know, pharmaceuticals and how parents treat their kids with lots of energy or anything like that. That's not my intent here. Mm-hmm. But a child who's left to live out the life for which he or she was bred, right? You know what I mean? Like, whatever was naturally, however they are, you go into flow state all the time, because you're living at your best. You're living at your optimal. You know what I mean? So for me, my childhood, it was a natural state of how my parents dealt with my energy. So I developed it. And the reason I'm so cautious saying, so yes, it was a gift. It was a gift because I didn't do it intentionally, but guys can absolutely do this thing intentionally. They have to, you know, they have to put themselves in experiences where they understand and experience flow, so that when the moment arises at work, or whatever they're trying to do, they can tap into it. And of course, a big part of going into flow is like detaching yourself from all the distractions. And that's why we don't see a lot of guys entering that state anymore, and they're having problems because of it, because we live in such a hyper distractive world. So yes, it was a gift for me, but then now that I understand it, I've learned how to cultivate it and use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I love the way you put that. And I think you're right on a lot of many levels, in terms of letting, especially parents, letting their children develop the skills that they were naturally born with, they're naturally, you know, supposed to excel in. And for you, that was your thing, like, you know, having this energy, this natural energy, this curious mind, this adventurous attitude, and your parents kind of let that shine, and also let the, you know, even looking into your brain, kind of talking about the physiology of things, letting your brain expand and the neuroplasticity and the connections of the brain connect in the way they should have, just to make things even better and more solid for you.
Yes, absolutely. And the science of it all is important. And I used to be way into that too. but I encourage guys to really, really want, really go in and experience it. You know what I mean? Because I think sometimes when we understand it, we're like, oh, okay, I understand it. Now it's there. Mm-hmm. Go and experience it is critical.
So what is the best way for guys listening right now? What is the best way to develop this flow state that you have? Maybe you are a little more gifted than they are. Maybe even a couple of the guys listening could be as gifted as you were in this sense. But for, you know, most people listening in general, what are some of the ways that they can develop this flow state? What are some of the ways that they can actually experience this firsthand?
First, you need to produce the space. You have to have the space to do it. That's important. So that means some open space, time, no distraction. Guys got to get off their phones and things like that. I watch grown men on their phone like an idiot middle schooler, like constantly looking. It's insane.
Yeah.
But you got to get that space because that'll interrupt any flow state. You got to get some space. Then you got to understand yourself, right? So for myself, I was clearly bred to hunt and fight and be outdoors and wrestle with things. You know what I mean? Clearly I was bred that way. And most of us are. If you think about it, thousands of generations, you know what I mean? We've been hunting and fighting. That's how we survived for eons. Only now are we in this new culture, this new environment. And of course, people are going to mate and breed with people that are more, you know what I mean, that have different likes. I'm not saying everyone's the same, but for the bulk of us men, most of us are that guy. That's the problem with masculinity, right? Masculinity, you only have one definition of manhood, but we're not just one. A lot of us are that one, but there's a whole bunch of other definitions as well. So you got to understand that, right? So like for me, being outdoors, on the water, swimming, running, doing distance stuff, jiu-jitsu, fighting, like real fighting, because I was, again, born to fight. But that doesn't mean I need to go around fighting people or hurting other people or anything for that matter, but I can replicate that. And then you've got to prove it to yourself. This is one of the biggest things. Anytime when I coach a group of guys and I do a talk on superhuman performance, I have a whole class on it, and I talk about flow state, how it elevates your mind, it elevates your thinking, it resets your brain, it gives you it. You're more inventive, you're more innovative, right? You can see things differently after you come out of that state. So you have to prove it to yourself. So for guys, I'd say like, okay, work on a problem, do whatever work you're doing, and then stop. Like if you look at my calendar right smack in the middle of the day, there's a 2-hour block that says workout. So I'll stop. And it's not that I'm working out. I should probably rename it. I am doing a workout, but I'm entering flow state. I'm making sure I'm doing something that's engaging enough and interesting enough to hold my brain, to detach it from everything else. And then I come back to work and I have more energy. I have an elevated mindset. I'm thinking about things differently, and I can prove the return on investment for the time it took to myself. So you understand what I'm saying? So yes, you got to open the space. You got to make sure you're not distracted. You got to find what works for you. But what's most important, you have to prove it, because we live in a very competitive environment right now, right? And we don't compete with our bodies. We don't go into factories and work ourselves all day. I mean, everyone thinks there's this term called hustle, like we're supposed to work ourselves like a machine, but that's not how it works. We're compensated in proportion to our ability to invent and design new things. So it's our brain that we need to be taken care of. And that's why things like flow state are so important, but that's why you have to prove it to yourself. Otherwise you won't repeat it. You won't do it all the time.
Yeah, no, I love that. What are some of the activities you do in that 2-hour block? Is it like meditation? Is it actually physically exercising? Is it some other things, maybe journaling?
Yep. So I will give you how my schedule is designed, but I want to tell everyone I don't do this 100% of the time. Like some weeks I'm perfect. Some weeks I fail half the time. You know what I mean? There's ups and downs in this, but the basic schedule that I come back to and hold will look like this. I'll wake up and I study for an hour every day. And that's important because, again, we live in a knowledge-based economy, right? So if you're not studying every day, you're out. That's why a lot of guys are it's getting harder and harder for them to produce revenue, to produce an income, because they're not sharpening the tool, the saw, so to speak. So I'll study for an hour. And then I write for 2.5 to 3 hours every morning. So my job is designed to support my flow state and just support myself that way. So that's fairly unique for me. And then in the afternoons, I have a workout block from 12 to 2, Tuesdays and Thursdays, I train in jiu-jitsu. And then Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I'll do something more long distance and endurance outside. And then if the surf is good, I'll be surfing. Today, we finally got the wind calmed down. and we had sun come back. So I did a paddleboard and a run, and then I do calisthenics and things like that. So it's a blend of working out and doing things that are fun inside of that. And I found that to be more important as I got into my 40s. In my 20s and my 30s, I could work out just for the sake of the pectoral muscles. And you know what I mean? That did it for me. But when you're, you know what I mean? When you're 40, I'm like, you know what? I don't care. You know, like those are useless. You know what I mean? They're good. They look good, but they don't serve any practical purpose. But then I wanted to put joy and fun into it. So that's why you'll hear that mix of paddleboarding and surfing, mountain biking, stuff like that.
I'm curious, what types of writing do you do for the 2.5 to 3 hours?
So I will write in support of not my blog so much, I guess. I put stuff on the site. You know, I share stuff with other people, but I'm basically writing. So I coach small groups of men, seven man groups of high performers throughout the year. So I'll write in support of the work I'm doing with them or what I'm learning from them. And that's really the core of my existence. Last a little over a year ago, I actually did a podcast with someone, and I was talking with them about kind of a shift and a pivot I wanted to make in my career. And I like to write, and I like to write books, but I'm not like Steinbeck or anything like that. But people buy and like the stuff I write because I'm solving performance problems for guys, and then I'm sharing, you know, who they are and how I did it. So everything I'm writing about is about human performance to some degree or the other, but not like not entertainment human performance, like this is how you actually perform better, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get it. And a couple of quick other follow-ups in terms of your daily routine. What time of day do you wake up? What time of day do you go to bed? And then how much actual like hours of work do you think you're doing throughout the day? If you could add it up, I'm trying to like think of the, you know, most people are working 8-9 hour work days. What do you think you're working?
So I wake up, I'm waking up a little earlier now because I just got a performance headquarters in South Orange County, California. So I'm waking up and going into that office now, which I usually would work out of a home studio. But I'm coming in every day to kind of get used to it and work it out. So now I'm waking up at 5. So I have a little drive time. So I'll wake up at 5. I'm working to get to the office about 5:30, but I have a Belgian Malinois, which are very aggressive, high energy dogs. So I'll stop on my way into the office and throw the ball until she starts just panting. So studying for an hour, writing 6:30, 7:30, 8:30. Yeah, 2.5 hours. And then from 9:30 to 11:30, I'm usually on go-to meetings, online meetings, coaching and training and working with people. So that's another couple hours right there. My blocks are about 2-hour blocks, and then I work out. That's part of work, 2 hours. And then I have another open coaching, period of time in the afternoon from 2:30 to 4:30. So that's 2 hours. So in a day, 1 hour, 3.5, 4, 5, 6, 7. So there's 7, 8, 9 scheduled hours. And again, 2 hours of workout is absolutely part of my work day because you need that to compete. So about 9.
Okay, cool. And then
now I sleep.
Yep.
And I always sleep 8 hours plus. Okay. Like that's, you got to sleep. You're competing. This is one of the biggest fouls. I see guys do this all the time. They're like trying to rob Peter to pay Paul. You got to sleep 8-9 hours. Your ability to perform, your mood, your energy, right? You can't do cerebral, you know, inventing difficult kind of work if you've slept 6 hours. It just ain't, you're not going to do it. So that's important.
Do they condition you in, you know, especially as a Navy SEAL, do they condition you in Navy SEALs to function off of deprived sleep, or is that sort of a myth out there? Because I've heard, you know, they mess with your sleep just to kind of mess with your mental functioning and deprive you of sleep and, you know, give you just a couple hours a night of sleep. Or is that something maybe reserved for just a small portion of the training?
Oh, no, it's not reserved for a small portion for sure. So Hell Week starts Sunday evening and it finishes Friday afternoon. So you can say, oh, on or about Wednesday, they let you fall asleep for like a little bit. And I don't know that that is to give you some sleep so much as to let your body slow down. And have you ever woken up really early and had to get in the shower and it's cold and like how hard that is?
Yeah.
So, you know, Wednesday and Thursday, they'll let you sleep a little bit, but it's my belief that that's only done just to let you get all comfy for a second, then wake you up and put you back in the surf, because that's what they do. And then obviously sleep is after Hell Week. That's a hard one because you think, okay, Hell Week is over. Like I went over the crest of the hill, but then you realize, nope, Hell Week was really just to prepare me for the rest of training. So you continue on about your business with heavy physical exertion and little sleep. And then it really just peaks at the very end in third phase. You go out to San Clemente Island for 30 days. I remember being the medic. I was the medic of my class, and I would tell guys all the time when we first got there, I'm like, dude, we're doing demolition, machine guns. They're going to let us sleep eventually. You know, you're only sleeping a few hours a night. And then no kidding, man, 3-4 weeks later, I was like, I don't think we're going to bed, boys. Like, this is legit. This is a month long. We're staying up. So you are, and it's important, right? Because when people lose sleep, their mood, their attitude, their cognitive function is diminished, like I was talking about earlier. So it's an important assessment to make of someone. Your morale is down. Like I was saying before, it's important we sleep when you're doing heady work or if you want to do anything exceptional, because if you're not rested, you're going to tend not to do it. And that's really what they're looking for in SEAL training. Like, all right, if they don't sleep, are they still going to be able to get up and do what needs to be done? But that becomes a product of self-discipline and flow state as well. So that is true. Not a lot of sleep in SEAL training. Not a lot of sleep. Lots of cold water, and that's why it's so damn difficult for people.
After the actual training itself, like the brutal first few months of it, does the rest of your tenure there, did they give you like normal sleep to kind of build you back up and that sort of thing? Or is it again, like for your entire time as a Navy SEAL, they're just kind of like fucking with your sleep?
Oh, no. After training, you're, you know, for all intents and purposes, you're your own guy and you're going to work like anybody else.
Okay.
You'll go into training blocks where there could be sleep deprivation, but that would only be because you're training for missions or doing something that required constant movement. It wouldn't be for that purpose. There's difficult times, but afterwards you're taking quite good care of yourself. You become most guys become extremely fit. That's when we get really good. Like, that's foundational stuff, SEAL training. It's the subsequent years after, the weightlifting, the taking care of yourself, the sleeping, the study. That's when you get really exceptional, I think.
Packed with 28 powerful nutrients, our Elite Life Nutrition's men's multivitamin is the perfect daily supplement to guarantee you're at your best every single day. As men, we have to do a million things, and oftentimes we overlook eating 100% optimally. But that's just the beginning. From work to sleep to gym to home life and more, oftentimes the stress can add up and start to take a toll on our bodies and our health. When it does, we see a significant drop off in energy, mood, stamina, strength, immune function, and yes, even performance in the bedroom. That's why it's so critical to ensure we're covering all the bases in terms of essential vitamins, minerals, and nutrients. And that's why you should really consider taking a powerful and effective and completely safe multivitamin supplement like our brand new men's multivitamin. Not only do we give you the critical amounts of vitamins and minerals, including powerful antioxidants like vitamins A, C, E, and selenium, and all of the B-complex vitamins, including niacin, B12, and folate, and extremely important minerals like magnesium, calcium, chromium, and zinc, but we also add in a men's vegetable and fruit blend to top off this nutritional boon. And all the forms of these nutrients are the best that money can buy. We leave no stone unturned. We give you the most absorbable and effective forms of these vitamins and minerals. Unlike so many other supplement companies out there that just go for the cheap synthetic stuff, our daily multivitamin comes with the perfect potencies from the ideal sources to make sure you actually reap the benefits of what you're taking in from a multivitamin supplement. After all, as a man, you deserve to be at your best. Go to elitelifenutrition.com/multi, that's MULTI, to order our men's multivitamin supplement right now. Again, that's elitelifenutrition.com/multi. I guarantee you're going to love this daily multivitamin. Okay, and then going back quickly to something you said earlier in terms of the flow state, I know you're dialed in on what you want to do in that moment, and that's how you're able to succeed and perform at your peak. How do you deal with the times afterwards? Like, say after the grueling 5 to 6 hours you were in the water doing some, you know, exercises, what about the time afterwards when it's kind of like resting again? What is your mindset at that point when you're not necessarily in flow state again, but how do you keep, How do you keep yourself sane and how do you keep yourself going?
That's the best. So that's a great question because that's the best part. My favorite, most happy, peaceful feeling in the world is that of exhaustion. So after something like that, I'm content, I'm happy, I'm patient. You know, all the fruit of a good life, right? That's why that stuff's so important. When I do these excursions, I do a sea, air, and land excursion with these small groups. And I just did a sea excursion last week. And I took these guys on electric mountain bikes, and I would attach a trailer with the paddle boards. And they'd be like, why don't we just put these on the truck? And I'm like, because we're getting exposure. We're letting our bodies, you know, we're draining our batteries. So the feeling is amazing. And right, that's when you start having the high serotonin levels and addictive type of things go away because you're content. I'm trying to think of the best words for it. What you just described is like heavenly for me. That's utopia. It's like, that's when you connect the two, right? Most guys are restless. That's why, you get in your 30s and 40s, guys find themselves drinking every night, right? And it's because they haven't drained the batteries. They still got stuff. You know what I mean? It's like taking a dog that you never walked all day, and then at night they're a pain in the ass. Mm. Same idea, right? There's an article on my site that talks about that. Are you bred to be bored? And I talk about a Belgian Malinois, which is a dog from the SEAL training pipeline. And I can observe her. If I don't work her and let her drain her batteries, she's like a mess at night, and I'm the same. So how I describe it after that, it's beauty. It's pure beauty.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. And, you know, kind of reminded me too what you just said about recharging the batteries and burning off that energy as well. Like every time when I was younger, if I had like a, you know, night of insomnia where I couldn't sleep or was restless all night and didn't sleep well, my grandmother would always say, you know, just go run in the backyard. That was her cure for any type of insomniac related episode. It was just, you know, go run outside in the backyard. But, you know, as silly as it is or was at the time, thinking like that was, you know, going to solve it all, there actually is a lot to that, like burning off that energy, being in touch with nature, using up the sort of restlessness that we build up throughout the day if we don't do anything. And I think your example of the dog who doesn't, you know, has all this energy, doesn't go out and burn it is a great one as well.
Oh yeah, it's important. It's a tough one, man, because I feel for people, especially guys. Like, think about it. If you can't sleep, it means you're not tired enough. It's your grandma that was genius. It was clear to her, right? She's like, oh, you're not tired, so go burn it. You know, burn it off. Guys are self-medicating. All the things guys do, and I'm not pointing the finger, man. I'm the worst of anybody. You know, I didn't live some perfect life by no means. But like now, if I'm in bed and I'm not falling asleep, all I think about is like, oh, I didn't burn it out. I didn't hit it hard enough today, right? And usually that's physical. It's physical and mental, right? Like you got to use your brain and engage your brain. That produces a certain kind of fatigue. But the other set of batteries are tied to your physicality, and you got to burn them all down. You know, that's huge. When I teach mission and purpose in life, I talk about flow state and I draw like 3, 4, 5 batteries. And I'm like, hey, here's your battery for your physicalness. Here's your battery for your cerebral, right? Here's your battery for your relationships, whatever the things is that feed you, that care for you, that drive you, those things have to be cared for. And it's kind of, I use the battery like an analogy, like the battery analogy. You got to drain them all the way out before you recharge them. Otherwise they don't do well. Mm-hmm. That's why guys end up working too much sometimes, by the way. Yeah. You know, it's not productive when they start working too much, but it's because they have a different battery that's still pushing energy into their system. And that's where you're like, I don't know, I worked 14 hours today, but I only got done 3 hours. It's like, yeah, you're getting driven by another battery that's from a completely different system.
Yeah. And not necessarily working the ones you should.
Yeah.
Eric, so if you can think back, what was the toughest part of your experience in the Navy SEALs? Was there a moment or, you know, maybe a couple or one that really stands out where you just kind of thought that you wouldn't be able to make it, or it really just pushed you to your mental and emotional limit?
Yeah, the Sundays were always hard because I'd commute back up to Orange County, which is about 65 miles away. And Sundays I'd have to leave. I'd have to leave my kids, my family, and go back to base and start cleaning the room, getting gear ready. That was always tough. But then you have your brothers there. and you see them, and that's your family too, and that's why brotherhood is so important, right? They allow you to do things that you would not be able to do without them. That was always tough. The toughest moment, if we were going to look like a perseverance story, is when third phase I was doing land navigation, and I was pretty good at land navigation. I have no natural sense of direction in me, but you give me a map and a compass, and if I, you know what I mean, and I'm doing the actual work of orienteering, I do well at it. And I, at recon, I'd be one of the few guys who would pass sometimes, you know, I could do this. But I made 180, it was snowing, by the way, in the mountains out east of San Diego, which is very uncommon. So that was really sweet. We had no snow gear. But I made a 180 degree mistake on a hill. And it was one of those ones where I went up and over the steepest part of the hills. I didn't walk around it or anything like that. Where that there's logic to that. But then sometimes when you're in the moment, you're like, I'm just going over that bastard. So that's what I did. I got to the other side, realized I made the mistake. And then I'm like, oh, crap. So then I kind of hustled myself back up and over the hill, the backside. And I lost a toenail or two. So I'd found my toenails, the little bloody toenail nubs in the snow. And I checked the map and just like, okay, let's be real careful now. And I realized I hadn't made a mistake. This is, so I was obviously tired or something was going wrong, right? And I'm like, holy crap, I had done, that was fun. I was supposed to go over that hill. I've just now crossed twice. And wow. I wouldn't say I was in a panic, but there's only a certain amount of time. So I ran back up and over that hill. And long story medium, on the back third of the course, the fatigue of the week set in, dehydration, not enough food, the cold, Ziploc bags covering my feet inside of my boots to keep them dry, just whatever it was. I found myself barely making it back to camp. And that's when I started thinking like, okay, what's my career going to look like? It looks like I'm about to fail this thing. But I knew I was going to get retested. And, so I kind of limped back to camp and I got to camp and I was just like smoked and I barely made it back. And I'm like, yeah, I failed. I, instead of trying to get the rest of the points, I had to turn straight back to camp. Cause I was like, I'm going to die. So I got to get back. And I'll keep the story short, but anyways, they'll retest you. And usually the retest is the next day. But they're like, Davis, you're going to retest today. Like in an hour, you're going to go. And I was so bad off. I literally had my buddies around me giving me M&Ms, food, everything's out of the MRE. They're trying to feed me because I'm like, I'm in deep shit here. And anyway, so I went back out and I did the course again. And by the time I finished it, I was literally going maybe 10 yards out of pop and just falling over in the snow. And by the grace of God, I'd gotten my points. I was very efficient on this one. And I literally came into camp, snow, freezing, pulled my shirt off. And the last thing I remember was going into like two or three sleeping bags with heat lamps getting put on me. And then I was out and I just blacked out, woke up the next morning. So that was the most gnarly. That's one of the heavier military training moments, you know, one of probably four or five where I was like, I'm very clear what it feels like to push yourself beyond limits. Like that's one of those times where I'm like, yeah, I know how that feels.
Wow. And the next day, did they just kind of, give you a break the next day or was it right back into training?
It was Friday. So we came out, cleaned up our gear. And, so the day there wasn't much, it was, you know, it was gear, you know, you're coming back in, it was gear cleanup. So there wasn't much going on. And the medic, the head medical guy just said, go home. And there was nothing going on anymore. And this is third phase too. So I've already been there. I was a good guy. So he's like, just leave. And I remember driving home, getting Jack in the Box, jalapeno poppers, Jumbo Jack with cheese. I was, you know what I mean? And just trying to refuel myself. So luckily it was Friday.
Wow. Wow. That is intense though, for sure. How did you deal with fear when it crept up, like in moments like that? And how do you currently deal with any type of fear if you get any from day to day stuff?
Well, back then I'd rely on, again, not knowing or understanding it, but I'd rely on my ability to go into that flow state. A lot of what I would do, my self-talk, is I would think about my kids. I'd be like, okay, if my kids were standing right there by that tree or wherever and watching me, how would I want them to see me move? That was a big part of it. Obviously accepting things for the beauty of when you're at your, here's the thing, when you're running at your best, you're optimal, you know, you're doing your best. There's not a lot of fear. right? Because you're like, hey, I'm doing my best. There's nothing more I can be doing. So there's a way you can accept the consequence, right? There's not a lot of worry and anxiety. Oftentimes worry and anxiety comes from when we're like, man, I'm not really at my best. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating. I'm not working out. I'm not, you know what I mean? I'm not doing the things I know I should be doing. I'm like, oh crap, I hope this works. That's how I deal with that then. Now being an entrepreneur and my life being of such where I could not have business planned my way into it. Now I'm very spiritual about it. So if I'm making risky decisions with business or anything like that, part of my study is I'm studying scripture in the morning as well. I'm in prayer. That's huge for me. And that keeps fear at bay big time, because for me, I believe I'm on a, like Blues Brothers, I'm on a mission from God kind of thing.
Yep.
So I'm not too worried, you know, like, hey, this is what you want me to be doing. I'm doing it. So it was like being in SEAL training. That was the beauty of it. Like, you just do what the instructor tell you, you know, so there's that way you can kind of let go. And it's the same way I am now. So now fear is dealt with a lot of spirituality, because I'm trying to do things that are beyond myself, right? I'm trying to do exceptional things. So if I'm just, I can't do it, right? I can't do it without kind of some sort of supernatural kicker. So that's how I do it.
I find sometimes that the people who are entrepreneurial minded sometimes take or have a hard time taking direction from superiors in terms of, like, you know, military. Entrepreneurs tend to want to be their own boss. And, you know, if you're in the military, you're a Navy SEAL, you have a lot of people to listen to and people to direct you and tell you to do things. How did you deal with the divide between your own free will, your own desires, and having to take that constant leadership and dictation from some of the superiors in military?
Not well at all, but I also had a lot of autonomy in the military. So when I was young and a medic, I ran the STD clinic, sexually transmitted diseases, all by myself. I was 18, barely 18 years old. So I learned right away, like, okay, if I study all the time and I teach myself how to do things and I'm performing above and beyond anything that anyone that's in charge of me can conceive, I learned right then, like, I'm going to run my own show, my own day. And that was my experience most of my military, career. So even, you know, in recon with the Marines, you don't have as much autonomy there. But you're still a very small team out on your own. You know what I mean? So that's not too bad. But the SEAL teams, you have quite a bit of autonomy. Like, it's big boy rules. You get your stuff done, how you get it done, when you get it done, etc. There's not a ton of that kind of structure, which drives other forces mad sometimes. I remember in a brief when I was back working with recon units as a SEAL, I remember a colonel saying, you know, do you know why we don't ever use SEALs? And I was like, what? I'm like, no, sir, I don't. Like, that's why. And he's like, because they don't stick to the plan. And I remember thinking, like, that is our job, is to not stick to the plan. Like, our whole purpose in life. So we're autonomous, we're dynamic, we're free thinkers, we're fluid. So I, you know, I did well there. I got, and again, just got really good at, when you're really good at what you do, people can't mess with you that much. So that's how I dealt with it then. Now, the big structure of the military was not good, because no matter what I did, I couldn't earn any more money for my family. Right? You know what I mean? There were certain kind of controls, and that's one of the big reasons I ultimately left, because I'm like, okay, I can't do anything to make more money or do other things. You know what I mean? Those are the kind of limitations that drove me nuts. And that's why I'm an entrepreneur, because I want to be the most effective and efficient I can be. Right. And that doesn't look like working 8 hours or working myself like a machine. That's old school. That doesn't work. So if I work for a company and they start trying to track hours or something like that, I'm like, this is never going to work. We can talk about performance. But yeah, I can't exist in that environment now.
Yeah, that's very interesting how you were able to pull it together, because you definitely have, you know, the entrepreneurial side in you now, but also enough of the structure oriented mindset or ability to adapt to that mindset, where you were obviously able to excel in that area, in the military especially. But yeah, I mean, it also seems like the Navy SEALs, like kind of the area that you dove into for the majority of your military career, was more willing to give you that freedom to be your own person and kind of do your own thing a little more than some of the other ones, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, like as a sniper instructor, I would write the schedule. You know, I'd write the course. You know what I mean? So when you're at that, so SEALs aren't like rigid like that. That's one of the, sometimes in movies, I'm like, what are they even, why would they even make them look that way when they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, they don't even ever act that way. They're, you know what I mean? They're like in the American Sniper, the movie Chris Kyle, there's like a guy obviously playing a sniper instructor, and that was me. I was a sniper instructor, and I'm watching this guy, and he's like, all like rah, 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 military. I'm like, that is not it. Like, we have lifeguard hats on and shorts, and we're sitting in our beach chairs teaching these guys how to shoot. We're it's casual because it's all about performance. And sometimes obviously intensity helps in performance too, but it's especially the SEAL teams are not military rigid like a lot of people might think they are.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. I read somewhere that you were the instructor for both Chris Kyle, the American Sniper, the movie the American Sniper is based off of, and also Marcus Luttrell, I believe, the Lone Survivor. Is that true?
So when Marcus came through, you know, there's a bunch of instructors, and we taught the whole class as a team of instructors. And then when Chris came through, we actually mentored particular students. All right, you would teach the class, but then you'd have your students. So for Chris, he was my student kind of thing. But of course, all the instructors were working together the same way we did. And Marcus Luttrell, and Marcus had put me in his book. There's a couple places in his book where he spoke of me in very high, very favorably. And that's a big reason, I believe. It was one of those catalysts that when I left the military, there's opportunities open to me just because some of the people I went to work for had happened to have read that book and thought, well, if this guy said these things about Eric, then, et cetera, et cetera. That was a bit of a, I believe a catalyst to some of my success was just that connection.
Cool. And so what are those guys like? Was Chris Kyle like, and Marcus Luttrell, was there anything in particular that might've stuck out about them, or were they just like as good as, everybody else, but happened to be put in the right situations to excel? Like, not taking anything away from either one of those guys, but was there something special about either one of them that stuck out to you?
Yeah, for sure. They're both Texans and stereotypical Texans, like good old boys and like men's men, which I always appreciated because I grew up in the Bay Area, in a suburb, even though I was outside a lot. But, anytime I come across Texans, and you don't usually come across those types in the Navy or the SEAL teams. That's not the huge percentage, I would say, coming from Texas. But yeah, that was it. The good old boys, solid, just solid guys of character and just performance and who they were for sure. I would say, yeah, especially in Chris Kyle's case, there is opportunity, or yeah, being in the right place at the right time is definitely, or in Marcus's case, the wrong place at the right time kind of thing. Those are the things that legends and stories come from, right? But it's also a product of their willingness to say yes over and over again, which both of them, I was amazed. I remember when Chris was back and he was at Sniper Cell, we were just talking, debriefing about his stuff. And I'm like, and he's like, yeah, I'm going back again. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? I was like, get out, write a book. You know what I mean? This was early on before all that stuff started happening. I'm like, you're good, dude. But that's the thing. They're the type of guys to be like, yeah, I'm going to go back again. Like, well, you know what I mean? Anyone would have been like, yeah, think about Marcus. That's like, yeah, I'm good. We can call that. You know what I'm saying? You get a situation like that. You're like, yeah, I have full 100% fulfillment of what the maximum experience I could have gotten as a military, as a SEAL, they both had, and they kept going. So amazing guys, both of them. Mm-hmm. Rednecks too.
Cool. You mentioned something about this earlier, and it just kind of reminded me again when you said Chris Kyle and Marcus Luttrell were sort of good old boys, Texans. What are your thoughts on masculinity currently as it stands in America? Is there some, do you think it's dying, as a lot of people in the media like to say, or some other, people of note like to frequently say? Is there something dying with masculinity in America? Is there a problem with it? Do we need to perhaps change some things?
Yeah, so here's the problem with masculinity. By definition, masculinity is the cultural expectation of how a man should act. So there's a few problems with that. One, our environment is changing faster than our culture can keep up with, right? So masculinity is never, ever going to work again because the culture can't keep up with it. And the other problem is I said this earlier, is that's a single definition of being a man, right? And so you're going to have one popular definition of manhood, and it's not going to fit or care for all the different, what I call understand your own breed, right? Just like dogs, there's a whole bunch of different breeds. Like people have been mating, human beings mate towards tallness, mate towards shortness. You know what I'm saying? Like we are separate breeds as well. So that can't work. It's never going to work. So imagine people outside of the traditional definition of masculinity. So one, it's jacked up because it's defined by news and social media and things like that. That's a terrible collective, right? Two, it's lagging. Again, our environment, we live in a hyper-competitive, knowledge-based economy, the most competitive one that this planet has ever seen, right? Going to the bar and picking, stuff like that ain't going to fly anymore, right? It doesn't work. And three, like I said, it doesn't fit everybody. So masculinity, they need to define manhood for themselves. Like manhood is not something you can't even from our fathers and our grandfathers. So when I had kids, I have older kids and younger kids. My older kids, I remember them getting on like MySpace or things like that showing up. Now my younger kids, they have everything at their fingertips. So my dad or my grandfather, they didn't grow up in an environment anywhere close to this. They could not have predicted it. So all of their ways of thinking and acting and behaving and believing, we know can't work now. Because you can't just go to work for 8-9 hours, come home, hit the recliner, watch Cops on TV, and fall asleep because there's too much going on. Kids need more from you. They need more guidance because they have more input points. So I went on the news a few weeks ago to talk about that. Masculinity is done. That's over. People have to define manhood for themselves. Same with women. Women have to define womanhood. What are the, and that's one of the things I do in my groups. Okay, what are the elements of life? How do we assess them? How do we prioritize them? How do we execute upon them? And these aren't things you can Google search because it's not in the collective anymore. It probably never is going to be.
You wrote a book relating to this subject called Raising Men from Fathers to Sons, Life Lessons from Navy SEAL Training. Do you talk about any of these subjects within the book, and if so, what are some of the lessons that you talk about in terms of what you want to teach younger men?
You know, I've gotten, when I wrote the book, I remember even thinking like, oh, I don't know that my path is going to be kind of manhood stuff. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's guys out there like manhood things, or even like your site, like there's manhood focused stuff. When I wrote the book, I did not believe that was going to be a focal point of mine at the time. And I'll explain the evolution real quick. But so raising men, if I were to describe it, the best way I can describe it, and I get women who read it and give me positive feedback, men without kids, the best way I can describe it is the story of me raising my son or my kids would be more accurate. While going through SEAL training, like I have jars of shells, of little shells I pick up off the beach while I was getting hammered in the sand for my kit to bring home to my kids. Like it was during, and I could see parallels of performance, and it was me filling in the blanks that my father left me, right? It was me pursuing experiences and knowledge that I can bring to my kids. So it's really a story of me growing up just ahead of my kids, right? Walking point, you know, leading from the front. And the things that I did to parent well. And I won't claim to be a parenting expert. I don't know that there actually can be such a thing as a parenting expert, because as soon as they're expert today, the world's going to change tomorrow. But that was the basis of raising men. And then, you know, as fate would go, that obviously got a lot of attention, or still gets a lot of attention, and lots of questions and requests about manhood and things like that. That all matched up with my own desire to continue to lead from the front for my kids. And there's a chapter in my book that's called Lead from the Front. And what I do is I'm countering the idea that a lot of men, I just heard too many times, a lot of guys say, I'm going to sacrifice my health, my fun, my friends, my fitness, my spirituality, so I can make a lot of money and take care of my family and my kids. And I'm like, that ain't going to work because kids are going to end up emulating your life, right? So if you can't live a happy, good, healthy life, then how are you going to teach them to do so? So I kept going down that journey, and then a little over a year or so, then that became my business, is to work with these small 7-man groups of men and then write about it.
So I think the takeaway here is that masculinity is certainly evolving, that it has changed over the years, and it's constantly changes. It will change in the future. But the real key is to figure out the man that you want to be, right? Like, figure out the values that you have and the things that you want to pass down to your children. And it's going to be unique to every individual, every man listening to the show, every man that you reach in your books and in your courses and speeches. I think every person has their own belief system of what it means for them to be a man. But I think it's reassuring for someone like you, a tough Navy SEAL guy, to say that, you know, you don't have to be necessarily tough, or you don't have to necessarily be the stereotypical badass masculine dude. You can be somewhere more balanced and in the middle of where what fits you, I guess, right?
Yeah. I would say masculinity, the word evolve, and when I hear evolve, I think to catch up with and improve upon. I think you know what I'm saying? So I think it will morph and change and pervert itself, but I don't think it's going to morph and change and pervert itself in a how we think of evolution, like in a good way. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to continuously be a problem in our society. I think guys, it's not about their belief. I what being a man is, it's about pragmatic study. Think about it. Like, you know what I mean? Do guys, all the things we learn and do, it's like, okay, well, break apart life. There are discernible, measurable elements to life that we can identify and assess. So it's more than belief. It's like, do the work. So I kind of say, don't be masculine, be a man, right? And that's you. That's for, you know what I mean? That's for each individual. And if you break it apart into all its pieces, then you really understand, like, okay, for me, this is how this would look like. And then you can live that life. And what's beautiful about that is when you come up against things, quote unquote, that are masculine, you, having done the work with confidence, you could be like, yeah, that's not for me. I've already thought about that, right? That macho kind of looking thing, like, yeah, that's not useful for me. You know, whatever it is, that, like, I've already thought about, people can stick to their guns with confidence that way. But you got to do the work. Like, you can't be a professional boxer. You can't be a professional football player. You can't be a scientist or a doctor without studying and doing the work. How the hell are you going to be a man without doing the work? Like, think about it. If you're not studying and working on it every day, you ain't just going to happen to get it right. Not today, not in today's world.
Is there one, like, big takeaway that you would say then, relating to that, that you would recommend guys do every day to figure out what it means for them to be their own men? Is there something that maybe they should consider doing every day, or at least maybe going forward for a few days until the time comes where they feel like they are the man that they want to be, or they're becoming the man they want to be? Is there some kind of exercise or habit or routine that you suggest maybe they undertake?
How I would explain it to anyone is, first, identify all the elements of manhood: mind, body, spirit, career, money, family, safety and protection, recreation. Like, identify, like, and people can do this for themselves. These things are, these things are out there, but identify, like, what are the elements, and then be inside of a group. You have to have a brotherhood around you. And I'm not talking about drinking beer and hanging out and going camping, although you should do things like that also, but be in a group of people who are deadly serious about their lives, who are like, yeah, let's all sit down. What are the elements of life? And then how do we make an assessment of those? How do we assess whether we're broken or good in our current situation or our future situation? And then prioritize them. Like, okay, I've looked at everything, guys. Here's my top three right now. And that's why I need other dudes around me. Guys, help me out here. What are some ideas? Hold me accountable. I'm gonna be the hero in my own life. I'm not gonna be the victim where I just deal with the anxiety of the moment. I'm actually gonna get these things nailed down and cared for. And that's not a few days or weeks, that's years. Mm-hmm. Just like, you can't become an orthopedic surgeon, which is infinitely easier than being a successful man in this day and age. You can't do that without years and years of study and being in a discourse.
Cool. Love it, man. Eric, just kind of wrapping things up here, is there a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience? It's been a fantastic interview, man. I really do appreciate you coming on. But what's a final takeaway message, and then also a place that our listeners can check out more about your work?
Sure. I would say at the core of what I'm trying to do is have people live a good life so that they can lead others to do the same. And if you think about that, that could be a big worldly kind of mission there. But the world needs, especially men, the world needs us to live well. And good men, when they live well, they don't typically just recreate and hang out, right? As soon as someone gets their life squared away and cared for, typically they're going to look outwards and see who they can help. So live selfishly, live a very good life so you can altruistically help others do the same. That would be my big takeaway message. And then, yeah, my site, ericdavis215.com. That has every, you know, I have an ebook on there. It's free, Habits of Heroes, the lesson or the four mistakes men make and how to solve for them. I have information about the groups, the small groups I coach and lead. I'm, depending on when this releases, I'm getting ready to open one up now. But I open them up periodically. But ericdavis215.com and everything I'm up to, if you get on one of the email lists there, I'll always share all the knowledge and the progress I'm making with you so people can follow it.
Awesome. Eric, thanks again for coming on, man. Really do appreciate it. I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.